Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this February 2010 installment of Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening, Jim Campanella. I want to start off this broadcast by talking about a TV program my kids watch. Both my almost 4-year-old and my almost 2-year-old love this show and get quite excited when it comes on television. Personally, I find the show bizarre and more than a bit disturbing, but I'll get to that. The name of the show is Dinosaur Train. Now, those of you with preschool kids may be familiar with this educational show, but let me tell the rest of you about it. The show follows the adventures of a family of pterodons who have adopted a T-Rex as a child. This alone made me wonder what type of medication the writers of the show might be on, but let me continue. The show also posits that dinosaurs, at some point in their multi-million-year history, not only had trains and train stations like those of modern times, but they also had the technology to build time-tunnel-like contraptions that could allow said trains, with dinosaurs riding upon them, to travel from time period to visit each other. My favorite episode, by the way, dealt with dinosaur poop, and how all dinosaurs poop, and how huge dinosaurs like the Megasaurus had poop like the size of boulders. My daughter's only comment was that she was glad that her poop was not that big because it wouldn't fit in the toilet, and I certainly was not one to argue with that observation. At this point, you may be wondering where the blue blazes I am going with this dribble. Please, be patient a moment, and you'll see. Now, one of the annoyances about the show is that the dinosaurs are brightly colored in almost every instance. I wish I could show you, but the T-Rexes are bright orange with blue spots, and the pterodons are blue and bright green. And I've done my reading, and I've seen Jurassic Park, and I was pretty darn sure that dinosaurs are dull-colored greens and browns, like modern lizards. I concluded that the brightly colored dinos had to be more of the medicinal effects on the TV show's designers. Right? Well, I was completely blown away by an article from Dr. Michael Benton, a paleontologist at the University of Britain in the UK, who has evidence that the animators of Dinosaur Train are not simply highly medicated. The research was published late in January in the journal Nature. Benton found microscopic features in fossils of dinosaurs that actually contained the remnants of pigments. The structures provide new clues about what these creatures actually looked like, including the possibility of patches or stripes with a sporty yellow or a red-brown color scheme. The fossils, some of them described for the first time, were found in northeastern China and well-preserved, with sub-micrometer-sized particles called melanosomes. In modern-day creatures, these melanosomes are pigment-bearing structures that come in two forms. There are cigar-shaped eumelanosomes that hold black melanin, and then there are the egg-shaped or near-spherical pheomelanosomes that contain pigments ranging from reddish-brown through yellow. The new analyses by Benton and his colleagues are the first to report structures that appear to be pheomelanosomes in the fossil record. The new findings provide tantalizing clues that dinosaurs and early birds weren't limited to a drab color scheme that I believed was the case. For example, the pattern of melanosomes in the fossils of Confucius ornus, a bird that lived about 125 million years ago in what is now China, show the creature likely had patches of white and black and orange-brown feathers. Cynosauropteryx, a dinosaur that lived in the same area a million or so years after Confucius ornus, probably sported alternating rings of white and orange bristle-like filaments on its tail. It turns out the scientists had been drawing dinosaurs with drab color palettes for years for just one reason. They had no idea what color dinosaurs actually were, so they were not going to go out on a limb and guess. Their best guess up till now was that dinosaurs were a similar coloration to modern lizards, much like I suggested. But it appears that they may have been wrong. Modern birds, the descendants of dinosaurs, may actually give us a better clue as to the original color of ancient dinosaurs than lizards do. I guess my lesson now is not to scoff at children's shows. The next story I heard from one of my friends and colleagues who participated in the annual meeting of the Society for Integrative and Comparative Biology in Seattle last month. She told me the story, and frankly, I was astounded. For years, scientists have pretty much agreed that plants are plants and animals are animals, and never the twain shall meet. Animals do not have chlorophyll and do not photosynthesize, and plants are almost always primarily autotrophs, that is, they make their own food. Well, Dr. Sidney K. Pierce of the University of South Florida has apparently found an animal that breaks those rules. He has discovered a sea slug that has stolen enough genes to become the first animal shown to make chlorophyll like a plant. Now, ironically, the sea slug, called Alicia chlorotica, is shaped like a leaf itself, and it already had a reputation for kidnapping the photosynthesizing organisms and some genes from algae. Now it turns out that the slug has acquired enough stolen goods to make an entire plant chemical-making pathway work inside its animal body. The slugs can manufacture the most common form of chlorophyll, which is the green pigment in plants that captures energy from sunlight. Pierce used a radioactive tracer to show that the slugs were making the pigment called chlorophyll A themselves and not simply relying on chlorophyll reserves stolen from the algae that the slugs eat. Pierce said that this green slug goes far beyond animals, such as corals that host live-in microbes that share the bounties of their photosynthesis. Most of those hosts tuck in the symbiotic cells in crevices or pockets among host cells and allow them to live happily there while taking advantage of their proximity. Pierce's slug takes just parts of cells, the little green photosynthetic organelles called chloroplasts, from the algae it eats. The slug's highly branched gut network engulfs these stolen bits and holds them inside slug cells. That is not just symbiosis. Some related slugs also engulf chloroplasts, but E. chlorotica alone preserves the organelles in working order for a whole slug lifetime of nearly a year. The slug readily sucks the innards out of the algal filaments whenever they're available, but in good light, multiple meals aren't essential to it. Scientists have actually shown that once a young slug has slurped its first chloroplast meal from one of its few favored species of algae, the slug does not have to eat again for pretty much the rest of its life. All it has to do is sunbathe. This is an amazing finding, not just for evolution and the Tree of Life, which, by the way, has now been thrown a major curveball, but can you imagine if we could do this with higher animals, with just a bit of genetic engineering? Photosynthetic cattle? Pigs? Chickens? Imagine how much we could save on feeding our food animals. There's only one problem. You'd have to get used to, well, yeah, I have to say it. Green eggs and ham. Okay. Onward and upward to the next story. Well, for years, scientists have been warning you that cigarettes are bad for you. The laundry list just gets longer and worse all the time. Emphysema, lung, mouth, and throat cancer, heart disease, strokes, etc. We all know this, and thanks to the amazing addictive capacity of nicotine, there isn't much that many people have been able to do about stopping. Well, here is another horror story about cigarettes that may induce you to put a nicotine patch on your arm. Dr. Amy Sapkata of the University of Maryland noticed something odd when she was looking at the smoking literature. She noted, quote, "Nearly every paper that you pick up discussing the health effects of cigarettes starts out with something to the effect that smokers and people exposed to secondhand smoke experience high rates of respiratory infection, but nobody ever talks about the cigarettes themselves as being a source of those infections." Unquote. Well, Sapkota's new data, published this month in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives, now suggests that that's a distinct possibility. What is frightening about Sapkota's data is that if bacteria actually are alive in cigarettes, then just handling cigarettes or putting an unlit cigarette in your mouth could be enough to cause an infection. The idea that cigarettes carry infections is not something new. We've known for years that cigarette tobacco carries plant viruses. I remember when I was a graduate student working on my doctorate, there were signs all over the big research greenhouses saying that you were forbidden from even bringing tobacco cigarettes into them for fear that you would pass along all sorts of plant viruses that would throw a serious monkey wrench into what might amount to years of somebody's research. However, the idea of live human pathogens in tobacco is quite new and not just idle conjecture. Several research teams have isolated bacteria from tobacco that could grow out in petri dishes. Sapkota says that those earlier investigations tended to hunt for and grow only one or two species of interest. What's novel in Sapkowska's study is that she and her colleagues probed for genetic material from any and every bacterium in a cigarette's tobacco. Under sterile conditions, they opened up cigarettes and then performed a series of tests on the tobacco. For instance, they isolated all of the ribosomal material and then homed in on its long series-specific DNA stretches known as the 16S regions. If you remember, ribosomes are those structures inside cells that actually make proteins. There's a big difference between the ribosomes in bacteria and the ribosomes in other organisms. Since plants do not have those 16S pieces of DNA, they could focus in on all the possible bacterial species present and compare the sequences of what they found to 16S sequences characteristic of known bacterial species. Sapkowska probed for almost 800 different bacteria and found matches to many hundreds in the four brands of cigarettes she screened: Marlboro Red, Camel, Cool Filter Kings, and Lucky Strike Original Red. Sapkowska bought all those packs of smokes in Lyon, France, where she was performing her research. She does note, however, that the companies who make those products represent the most commonly smoked brands in westernized countries and the three major tobacco companies. Among the germs whose DNA laced these cigarettes were Campylobacter, which can cause food poisoning, and Guillain-Barré syndrome, Clostridium, which causes food poisoning and pneumonia, Cordybacteria, also associated with pneumonia and other diseases, Klebsiella and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, both of which are associated not only with pneumonia, but also with urinary tract infections, and a number of Staphylococcus species that underlie the most common and serious hospital-associated infections. Wow, doesn't that just make you want to run out and light one up right now? Probably not. All right, I'm going to end with a story about cannibals. Well, it's sort of about cannibals. Kuru is a disease that was discovered by missionary doctors in New Guinea islanders in the 1950s. Now, these islanders performed what you can call ritual cannibalism. Ritual cannibalism is eating your friend, neighbor, or relative when they die as a form of respect, to take up a part of their spirit and memorialize them to some degree. Well, Kuru was found among these cannibals, primarily women and children. And the symptoms of Kuru include coordination problems, eventually becoming quite severe, difficulty walking, and this is called cerebellar ataxia, difficulty swallowing, tremors, muscle jerks, these are called myoclonus. Difficulty swallowing and the inability to feed yourself leads to malnutrition and starvation, and it can take up to 30 years or even longer to develop the symptoms. That's a very long incubation period. It took a while for the doctors to figure out why it was mainly women and children that got the disease. Eventually, they noticed that at the funeral ceremonies, the men got served first and got all the best bits of muscle and tissue from the honored dead person. The women and children got served second and got the not-so-nice bits like the nervous system and the organs. The reason that the women got sick is because they specifically were being exposed to a pathogenic agent that the men were avoiding. It turns out that the disease is passed along by eating the brains of the dead who are infected by a very strange protein called a prion. A prion is a protein that infectiously causes normal proteins to fold abnormally, which in turn causes still other related proteins to do the same. This affects the other protein's ability to function. It takes so long to show symptoms because it takes a very long time to convert over the good proteins and cause them to become bad. But once that occurs, then it's all downhill. Once the symptoms actually start to arise after the incubation period, well, then the disease is fatal in about a year. Prions are the same agents that cause mad cow disease in cows, scrapie in sheep, chronic wasting disease in deer, and other rare human diseases such as Gerstmann-Straussler-Shanker disease, fatal familial insomnia, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome. In some weird sense, the prion is kind of a Jekyll and Hyde sort of molecule. The prion is the Mr. Hyde, which does all the bad things and causes the fatal neurological disease. In that twisted Mr. Hyde form, the prion protein causes the fatal brain-wasting diseases. And up until now, it's been very unclear what the normal form of the protein might be. A new study from Dr. Adriano Aguzzi at the University of Zurich, reported in the last Nature Neuroscience issue, suggests what the Dr. Jekyll version of the prion might be doing in our bodies. The normal form of the protein, which is typically found in neurons in people and other mammals, is the good guy. The protein may direct cells called Schwann cells to wrap around neurons and produce myelin, a type of insulation that aids electrical communication between nerve cells. This newly discovered role for the normal Dr. Jekyll form of the prion protein could link the protein to nerve disorders called peripheral neuropathies. In the new study, Aguzzi studied several different strains of genetically engineered mice that lack the good Dr. Jekyll prion protein. The researchers found that the mutant mice from all the strains had abnormal myelin sheaths around their sciatic nerves. That's the long nerve that runs from the lower back to the foot. Electrical signals travel more slowly down the sciatic nerves in mice that lacked good prion proteins, compared with mice that had intact prion proteins. One interesting observation that Aguzzi made was that restoring the functioning of the good prion proteins to the nerve cells allowed the myelin sheaths to be required. However, putting prions back into Schwann cells did not. That result suggests that the prion protein is needed in the neuron but not in the Schwann cell. Additional experiments show that the myelin repairs happened only when the prion protein could be snipped in half. That cleavage frees part of the protein, which then signals the Schwann cells to make myelin. The researchers don't know yet what cuts the prion protein or how the Schwann cells detect the signal at all. Now, in the past, a wide variety of functions have been proposed for the prion protein, but researchers have not been able to replicate results using different strains of mice. Aguzzi's new study seems to be the first reliable one that finds the same results for many genetically different types of mice. If it turns out that Aguzzi's work really is correct, this could cause a problem for scientists doing research to make cattle resistant to prions and mad cow disease. The way they've been doing that has been by genetically engineering cows to simply not have the good Dr. Jekyll version of the prion protein at all. Presumably, if the animal doesn't have that protein in their brains, then they can't be infected by the bad Hyde version of the prion protein. If Aguzzi's work is correct, and if the prion protein does play a role in myelin formation, that could pose a problem for gene therapy that removes the gene from cattle and other animals. Mice and other animals that don't have the gene can't be infected with prion diseases, but the question remains whether removing that gene, removing that protein, can cause peripheral nerve problems. The question is still completely up in the air. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Think twice about joining Joe Camelin lighting up that coffin nail, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella. And hey, be honest, aren't you guys missing the ant stories about now? Good night, everyone.